G'day, it's Michael Cathcart here. You are so very welcome to Books and Arts here on RN. And today we journey beyond the vinyl frontier to discover LPs, which somehow link music and the operations of the human brain. You'll discover the mystic Rosemary Brown, who claimed that dead composers dictated new works to her. And two books which focus on the Australian bush. Alice Robinson discusses her new novel set on a farm, where a young girl is shouldering everyone else's responsibilities. And first, Don Watson, Australia's most famous speechwriter, talks about what the bush means to him and to all of us. Well, I suppose that Australia really got to know Don Watson when he was working as a speechwriter for Prime Minister Paul Keating. Keating's 1992 Redfern speech and his speech for the Unknown Soldier are now part of our collective memory, aren't they? Don's account of that time, Recollections of a Bleeding Heart, won a swag of major awards, including the Age Book of the Year. Don also attracted attention in 2003 with his bestseller Death Sentence, a prize-winning book about the decay of public language in Australia. And you remember at that time, Don revived that term weasel words. Well, last year, Don won Book of the Year in the Indie Book Awards, an award voted on by booksellers, and he won it for a hefty read called The Bush, Travels in the Heart of Australia. And the central question that Don asks is why we invest so much of our national identity in the bush. And he has a fair bit to say too about his own encounters with the diverse countrysides of Australia. So what did the bush mean for Don when he was growing up?
Well, it meant a regressive state. We would never have called ourselves people from the bush, or bushies much less. But I heard Ian Sinclair to call himself a bushy the other day, and I thought, well, if he's a bushy, I don't know what we were. No, we were from the country. We were independent, small proprietors. Letters came addressed J.D. Watson, Esquire. These were unimaginable things that, you know, 140 acres of near-vertical land covered in blackberries could do for you.
So the term bush meant the scrub, did it?
That was whence we came, you know, and we didn't want to go back.
Yeah.
And what remained of the bush... In retrospect, I can now see there were still bits of bush around. You know, the understory was still there in one paddock, and of course the bracken was a perennial. You could never get rid of the bracken. And there was still the odd blue gum standing out there that the odd koala would clamber up every year. But the lightning picked them off, and the white ants. Not the koalas. I suppose it did, effectively. No, but I mean, it was very... You know, this is a strange thing, this sort of fashion for the bush and calling it the bush. I mean, we would never have thought that. We were on the land.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. I remember driving with my grandfather, and if you came to a big tree, we used to drive in the Dandenongs outside Melbourne. He'd come here. When my grandmother and grandpa came to Melbourne from Adelaide, they were from, we'd drive up into the Dandenongs to look at what my grandmother called the autumn tints. And she loved the autumn tints. Yeah. But my grandfather, whenever we came to a big tree, he'd say, oh, there'd be a fair few fence posts in that old fella. Yeah. And he did it partly to rile us all. He knew, you know, he wasn't an idiot. He knew what he was saying. But it used to make Grandma go, oh, Lloyd. She'd say, Lloyd.
Yes. Well, I can understand that we looked at the land in terms of its usefulness, you know, so... There was one English visitor complained about the way all grass was called feed. Everywhere you went, you looked at feed.
That's right, yes.
Good feed there, feed there. And that continued for a long while, and I'm sure. I mean, I found a diary of a railway surveyor who just kept looking for ballast and sleepers, which is a bit different to looking for feed. It made quite a nice change.
Yeah.
Across all that Spinifex country, but he was just looking for what made a good sleeper or what might be useful for putting over the sleepers.
So the book, I mean, this is a wonderful book, Don. I've just so loved reading it. You talk about the selectors in in Gippsland, which is the country where he grew up, and you've got this great line, you say, a good burn was like the creation. What's going on when that's the case?
Well, this was already sort of part of folk memory when I was growing up, that blue gum mountain ash forest was cleared largely by burning, by saws and axes and burning, and they were, they worked out a way of heaping it all together by notching trees up a hillside so that when they cut the ones at the top down, they all came down in a beautiful pile. And then they waited for the hottest possible conditions and rode around it with torches and set fire to it so you could get a burn that absolutely cleared everything, reduced the entire forest to fine right. white ash.
So if you did it right, you just had to knock down a couple of big trees and they'd just take the rest with them like dominoes.
They'd take them like dominoes and then they would sort of... had very little to do except set fire to it on a day when it was 100 degrees and there was a hot northerly blowing. The ones that make us all flee to the city, they just look forward to it.
They'd say, hooray, it's a bushfire.
That's right. And then they would suddenly see the sky and maybe even a neighbour that they weren't aware of until then. And this was the clearing. And as I said, it was like creation because from then on they could start getting their crops in. And on that ancient soil they grew magnificent crops.
I thought it was a great image because it reminds us of the fact that so many of the early settlers thought of the bush as this great grey silent zone where time had been pretty much suspended. It's as if nothing had happened. And the they knew Aborigines were there, but they were living in a great eternal kind of timelessness. Mm. And then suddenly when white action comes, it's as though the story has begun.
Yes, exactly. And they would often use the term neglected forest or neglected wilderness, as if the Aborigines, insofar as they were there at all, didn't make any useful, you know, use of it. And so what they were doing was sort of letting in the light. Clearing, after all, comes from clarus, and my Latin's very non-existent, but it means light, effectively. And letting in the light might have been God's light. If it wasn't God's light, well, it was certainly the light that would allow pumpkins to grow. And then you could just sort of push on from there. Mm. So it was a sort of sanctified act, I think, as they saw it.
As I was reading your book, I could feel the influence of Bill Gammage's book, The Biggest Estate on Earth. I wonder how you took Gammage's argument that actually there's no such thing as pristine bush, that the whole of Australia was actually shaped by Aboriginal action, that they are the authors of all the different countrysides of Australia.
Yes, I wouldn't argue that. Bill's book came out at a very opportune time for me. I'm glad it didn't come out 6 months later because it probably would have made a fool of me. But I keep running into people who grumble about Gammage, and no doubt they'll grumble about me. There's an awful lot of argument about how the bush was made and how it works now. I spent last week a couple of days in Bathurst with Peter Andrews, the natural sequence farming man, who's got very firm opinions about many things. But I think there are probably... Well, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I've spent quite a lot of time up in northern Australia and there's no question that land, you know, you can see how it's farmed still. Mm. Unless you get out in the areas where the cattle are, which do much more than any Aboriginals can.
Well, one thing you say in the book, which echoes Gammage, is that many of the settlers arrived to find very dense understory and really had a job clearing it. And if Gammage is right, that was actually a sign that the bush had become neglected because the Aborigines had already been driven away and were no longer using fire to manage the understory.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And you can see precisely that in northeast Arnhem Land, for instance, where it's still burnt a lot of the time, but increasingly not with the sorts of fires that you... not with the cool fires or with the skill that used to be practiced.
Well, this is where it gets political, doesn't it? Today, when people are talking about clearing the land, so you get some environmentalists who are in favour of burning and other people say the Aborigines never burnt the land this often and it kills everything. And there's all this sort of second guessing of what Aborigines, you know, used to do.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I don't know that we really know, but I think we do know that if you took a place like the Mitchell Plains, you can... And you see, you know, this is what it was all hidden in plain sight. I mean, it's in Mitchell's diaries when he sees all these great, beautiful Mitchell plains. He says he actually uses the term work, very rarely used in connection with Aborigines by white settlers, that this is all the result of Aboriginal work.
Yeah.
A breath later, he's saying it was put there by God, but for the use of Aborigines. But the huge irony is that they created perfect conditions for pasturing animals. And
because the big parks the big grassy parks that the explorers saw, which they described as gentlemen's parks, were indeed parks. They were parks that the Aborigines had created for exactly the reasons that English people created parks. That was for hunting.
Exactly. And they were destroyed with incredible speed. Mm. We used to drive through one of those parks every now and again in East Gippsland, which was just dotted with skeletons of river redgums. And that had been, it's described by Angus McMillan when he went through there as this, you know, grass up to their girths. And
He's one of the great pioneers of Gippsland, one of the famous pioneers.
Yes, and that's all gone. That was gone in a flash. In fact, all the trees there, I was told, and it turned out to be true, by the man who had McMillan's old station. They were all killed by Christmas beetles in the 1860s, 20 years after settlement, simply because, I then found out, of sheep camping under them and destroying the insect life which protected them from Christmas beetles and the fungi and these sorts of things. So it didn't take much.
This is Books and Arts on RN. I'm talking to Don Watson about his lovely new book, which is called The Bush, and it's a hefty book indeed, and it's just won the Independent Booksellers Award, the Indie Book of the Year, it's called. And so we thought we'd get him in to have a chat about it. I'm sort of reminded, Don, when I read you, of Mark Twain, and I know you've always thought the world of Mark Twain. Is there something about Mark Twain's aspirations to write in an American voice, a voice of the common people, that is working in you as you find a language to tell this story?
I'd hate to think that I was even unconsciously imitating Mark Twain.
No, I don't mean imitating him, but that his example is somehow putting petrol in your motor.
I don't know. I think he's, I mean, I love the tone of Mark Twain, and it seems to me that tone is everything in writing. It's like a train getting its wheels on the tracks. Until you find the tone, you really can't write the way you want to. And I think every book and every article actually has a tone, and each one should be a little different to the other, depending on the subject matter, I suppose. And I struggled to find the right tone for this.
Do you feel like reading a bit?
I'll do anything.
Anything for publicity. What if you just read us from, as I hand the book over to you, from the first page, oh, I don't know, down to the end of the first paragraph, the top of page two. And if we feel we want more, I'll just indicate that.
You mean right from the beginning?
Right from the beginning, yes. Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm sorry to say that the second word in this book is misspelt. Although it's spelt properly throughout the book, the word fuchsia has the S after the CH, but someone pointed that out the other day, and it made me...
Well, thank you for sharing that with the nation. We'll all notice that now when we go and buy our copy.
Drive you mad. Anyway, this is the opening of the book. I remember my mother's father in a tattered hat and trousers tucked in his rubber boots, striding like Hiawatha across the paddock from his cowshed. I remember her mother sweeping. He strode, she swept. She swept as if not to sweep might let the devil onto the back veranda. Every morning she beat the gum leaves and cypress debris from those boards, and then from the steps that ran down to the garden, and the path that led past the vegetables and the currant bushes and the lucerne tree that blocked out a view of the milking shed, and the pig pen, one side of which was a fallen tree trunk. And onto the back gate, the wood heap and the lavatory in the shade of the cypresses, a grim watchtower with a bench seat of well-worn planks from which one could see through the cracks in the door to the chopping block, the place where the old house had been before the great bushfires of 1898, and the distant blue-green hills. Everywhere she wielded the broom with elbow grease and grim purpose. The back veranda was her frontier, those steps the ramparts of her civilization. The front veranda she swept less often. Like most front verandas in the Australian countryside, it was not much used. The front garden with the big white azalea, the bee bush and the foxgloves, she kept in good order, as she did the side one with the snapdragon, cineraria and wallflowers. But all visitors save inexperienced travelling salesmen, Jehovah's Witnesses, and city motorists with flat tyres or boiling radiators came in by the back door. She would say, "I expect the men will be in soon," and the men would come lumbering up the steps. The men were her husband and sons, and they came in for lunch, called dinner, and morning and afternoon tea. They moved with a stiff-backed, stiff-buttocked gait of farmers everywhere, scattered the flies from their backs with their hats, let the wire-screen door slap behind them on its rat-tail spring, and sat down in the kitchen with a sigh or a groan. The groan was partly because their joints and muscles ached with effort, partly from habit, and partly an imitation of their elders. It was a noise from deep within the culture. There had been no house 50 years earlier, no farm 30 years before that, but the sense of the house and the farm and the people was that they had always been there.
Don Watson reading from his book, The Bush, and he's my guest this morning here on Books and Arts on Radio National. You're with Michael Cathcart. Yeah, that's a powerful piece of writing. And you also write with great affection about your dad, who was a dairy farmer in Gippsland. You write very lovingly about the way in which he split wood.
Yes. Oh, I was very reluctant to write about my father. You know, it becomes a very boring habit of late middle-aged men to suddenly, you know, overcome their Oedipal rebellion and start writing lovingly about their fathers.
I loved him all along.
I also thought, well, you know, when I'm in an old person's home, that may be something I can do usefully, you know, dictate it to a nurse or something. But anyway, I've blown it now. It's in here. But yes, when I thought about it, I didn't know where to start. And I thought, well, I'll start where I started. And the thing that occurred to me about farming is that there are really two kinds of farmers. There are farmers who are sort of zen-like, which was my father. And there are farmers who are more what we used to call bull at a gate, you know, that they will bodily lift animals around rather than coaxing them with whistling in their ear or patting them, if you know what I mean. They can make a dog do anything, and farmers who just shout at the dog and pelt it with clods and go and get the shotgun. And
my Uncle Jack was like that. You silly dog, he'd keep saying. You stupid dog. Stupid dog. Get back. Get behind, stupid dog.
Stupid dog. Yeah, well, he was a polite grandfather. Although mine didn't swear much either, only the sort of good Old Testament sort of curses. But the thing was that, you know, I think somewhere I said it's a bit like playing a piano farming. You know, it's sort of measured violence. You do it so that you don't exert yourself more than you have to. So that if you split wood, something I learned to do by watching him, although I could never split logs with massive knots in them like he could, but you know, you didn't split it so hard that the pieces went flying and you had to walk two steps to pick them up. And you never hit it harder than you needed to for this reason. But you hit it hard enough so that your axe didn't get jammed. And there was a little twist you had to make of it so the wood flew off rather than got stuck in there. It was a terrible day if you jammed the axe in the wood and you had to go inside knowing it was stuck in the log out there. And you felt really feckless.
Yeah. Yeah, I can absolutely see that. So this book alternates between you remembering your parents and your own childhood and your experiences through life and your reflections on Australian history and Australian attitudes. When do you think we started to view gum trees with affection?
I don't know. It seemed to depend. There's a nice piece by Edwin Kerr, writing in the 1880s, saying there were sort of two types of settlers. Some of them just couldn't stand living on such a massive continent and would never develop any affection for gum trees. Except, you know, all they did, when they saw a gum tree, they wanted to ring bark it, that was basically, or cut it down and do something with it. You know, I think it... On the other hand, I think Tim Bonahady had somewhere wrote a whole book on the subject of, you know, the other indication, which was that there were people who fell in love with them quite early on.
I mean, I suppose the thing you've captured in the book, which is so powerful, is the way in which you understand that Australia is a conversation, that there actually isn't an Australian attitude. There are conversations, there are contentions, there are points of argument, and that's what you're doing right through the book. As we wind up, there is just one thing I wanted to ask you about. You reckon that a good-looking Jersey cow looks a bit like Audrey Hepburn.
She looks more like Audrey Hepburn than she looks like, say, you know, Carol Lombard. You know, she's they're lovely, pretty little cows. And I didn't love cows as a boy, but if I were to love a cow, it would be a Jersey rather than one of those big industrial Friesians.
You know, the really scary thing, Don, is I read that sentence, I thought that's completely ridiculous. So I went to Google Images and I got a dairy cow, put it on my desktop, got Audrey Hepburn, put her on my desktop, put them side by side. And listener, a Jersey cow, a nice Jersey cow, just looks exactly like Audrey Hepburn.
Oh,
it's a spooky fact. It's a lovely book. Congratulations. Congratulations on writing such a fine thing, and congratulations on winning the overall award at the Indie Book Award.
Thank you, Michael.
Good on you. Don Watson. His book is called The Bush, Travels in the Heart of Australia, and that one's published by Hamish Hamilton. And it took out the overall award in last year's Indie Book Awards. This is Books and Arts on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. Well, now let's look at a novel that tackles the theme of the Australian bush. Lonely girl. Lonely girl from Australian singer Sarah Humphrey. Well, have you heard the term cli-fi? This stands for climate change fiction. I'm not sure the term will last, but I guess the idea will. There have always been novels about our relationship to the land, and stories are starting to emerge that trace disquiet about the weather as well. And one of these is from the Melbourne writer Alice Robinson, whose debut novel, Anchor Point, is set mostly in regional Victoria. There's a child at the centre of the story. Her name is Laura, and her anxiety and labour, she has to work awfully hard, Kate Evans tells me, really anchor this story. Alice Robinson is speaking here with Kate.
Your novel begins in a farm kitchen. Who are the players? Can you describe Kath first?
So Kath is the mother in the story, and she is kind of bohemian. She fancies herself an artist, and she's relatively disinterested in motherhood. I think I perceived her... The fact that she's got children is kind of an accident or a misfortune for her. She really wants to just be making art. And living with her are her two daughters, Laura, who's 10, and Vic, who's 5, and her husband, Bruce, who couldn't be really more different from her. He's sort of a man of the land. He's a farmer. She's also a German migrant, whereas he's firmly, you know, from Australia. He's very Australian kind of... farming man.
So is this a story of gender relations and domestic disharmony?
I think that's one strand of the story, certainly, and a kind of surprising strand for me to discover as I was writing the book, because as you may have gleaned from reading it, my interest going in was pretty much purely environmental. I wanted to write a book about climate change, and that was my concern at the time and continues to be. But, of course, fiction's really about people, so I had to find a way of turning my potentially didactic interest into a human interest story. And I think when you're writing about people, you're writing about families, relationships, and so there is that domestic element that is necessarily there, I think.
Because Kath is filled with immense frustration, bitterness even, leading to a huge amount of tension.
And I think part of that tension is perhaps universally felt when one has little children, you know, between the parents' own interests, the pressures of their work, their various works, and this kind of leftover work, which is the domestic work, the making the dinner, the doing the washing. You know, who does that work when both parents work in other ways? And part of the discord in that family is that the father, Bruce, doesn't appear to recognise the mother's work of art making as real work. You know, he perceives work outside, you know, chopping wood and moving, you know, the sheep and clearing the land as the real work. And he also has very conservative ideas about what she should be doing in the house, that she should be doing that domestic work.
So what does that tension mean for Kath's daughter, Laura?
So she perceives that tension acutely, as children do when they live with disharmony in a household, and feels responsible for, almost kind of in an unarticulated way, she feels responsible for smoothing things over between her parents. So she tries to step into Kath's shoes. She tries to do the things that Kath leaves undone so that Bruce, the father, won't get angry. And in a sense, she's trying to protect them both from each other, which, of course, is a bit of a folly when you're only a child. And it also means that she misses out a little bit on her childhood. You know, she's working very hard in a way that really no 10-year-old should have to.
Well, Laura is the focus of the book. She shoulders all the responsibility. How did you find her as a character?
do you mean how do I relate to her? Or
how did you uncover
her
and build her?
That's an interesting question. The kind of nuts and bolts answer would be that I just wrote and wrote and wrote, and she sort of emerged like a photograph developing from a negative, if you like, or a Polaroid kind of coming to the surface. Perhaps also I drew on parts of myself. My father still lives on part of the land where he grew up on as a child. He grew up on a sheep farm. And so he told me many stories about that life in which he did have to work quite hard as a child. You know, he had chores and a lot of his stories revolved around the labour that was done.
And there are a series of almost ambivalent relationships with the land or ways of engaging with it. And Bruce, the father in the story, he takes out his grief by conquering the land, stripping it bare. And in the novel, you see the ravages of that. But you're also quite sympathetic to him, I think.
Yeah, well, I think he is acting according to the knowledge that he possesses. He gets quite angry at one point in the story with Laura's kind of environmentalist greenie boyfriend. They have an altercation because their understandings differ so widely as to, you know, how this land should be cared for. So I do feel sympathetic towards him, even though the actions that he takes to sort of care for the land in the way that he knows how have pretty devastating consequences. And I think there's also, you know, for Laura, her ambivalence about the place, it's almost as though her life is charted from the get-go, because she sort of stands to inherit this massive workload, but that workload, as I said, kind of is intermeshed with a belonging. So when she tries to move away, she risks losing this sense of place or this home or this belonging, but she also kind of unhooks herself from all that work as well. So she's sort of trapped, if you like. She can move away and be without the place and the work, but then she's unmoored from those things too.
And she is close friends with a local Aboriginal boy who knows the land she lives on, and there's a canoe tree there, for example. They're real allies. But she does seem to remain unsure about an Aboriginal claim to the land.
Absolutely, and I think it actually unsettles her to consider it, and that's probably why she doesn't, and in a way that perhaps many settler Australians feel a little bit anxious about what that might mean, the fact that these places that we call home, that we're very connected to in the way that Laura's connected to her place, might actually be somebody else's place in a much deeper and more long-standing way. And I think that's partly why she never really interrogates the idea of the canoe tree. You know, just the very thought that there was someone there before her is deeply unsettling to her.
Now, Laura ends up spending time in Sydney, and I'm speaking to you from Sydney, and you describe it as always raining. Why?
In some ways, I was taking liberties with the idea of the climatic changes we might experience as time goes on. So Laura's town, Kyrie, or the part of Victoria where she lives, the fictional part, it becomes increasingly dry. But I wanted to offset that with a very wet experience, which is both because so the rain that she experiences in Sydney is startling to her by comparison, because she's been living with deep drought for a long time. But in my sort of version of the timeline of the locations, Sydney does experience higher than average rainfall. But that's also an interesting kind of thing we're seeing happening, that, you know, one part of the world can be very dry and just up the road, you know, another part can be extremely wet. These variances of climate that we are finding surprising, you know, are happening. And I wanted to be able to explore those very different responses to weather and different weather patterns.
Because while it's raining in Sydney, back on the farm there's fire and extreme weather.
Yeah.
But this did seem to me very strongly a novel about gender and domestic tensions, memory and secrets. But would you want to describe it as a climate change novel?
I am happy for it to be described as such, but I think all of the things that you're talking about are equally at the fore of the kind of the finished product. So I guess the climate aspect was what I went in with, and what emerged through the writing process were all the things that you're talking about as well. And I think that's natural and that's right in fiction, because as I was saying, you know, it's extremely hard to write a whole novel about simply about the landscape. It really has to be about people and those other concerns. And as we're finding, you know, in our contemporary experience, the landscape is really, perhaps unfortunately, at the bottom of the list of our concerns. We're more concerned with our own experiences and our own lives. Perhaps if we were more concerned, then we would be doing more to address climate change, for example.
There's an apocalyptic vision of Melbourne right at the end of your novel. It's 2018. So what then do you want to do as a fiction writer by imagining this version of the near future? Is it a warning? I mean, what is it you want to do as a writer with a vision like this?
I think it is a warning, and I think although the work of writing is a lot more introspective for me, at least, I was looking for an outlet, I suppose, to the anxieties that I felt but found hard to voice in any other way. You know, there's a part of the story where Luke, the environmentalist boyfriend of Laura, makes a crack at a dinner party, you know, when someone says, well, what should we do then? And he says, take my advice, get your own source of water and be prepared to defend it, or something like that. And I, you know, I've been known to say similarly potentially outrageous things at dinner parties myself, probably offending people. And that's not the right outlet, if you like, but exploring those kinds of anxieties, you know, what will we do in the future if we continue to experience very dry weather? Fiction is a wonderful way of kind of working through that. And so to some extent that's what I was doing, finding a way of exploring these ideas.
Sweet, lovely you. Sweet, lovely you.
Alice Robinson's Anchor Point is published by Affirm Press, and she was speaking there to Kate Evans. And the music you heard was from the Australian singer Sarah Humphreys, her new CD, New Moon. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is Books and Arts on RN, where it's time now for Top Shelf, an eclectic collection of artistic and other inspirations from a well-known writer.
I'm Atticus Lish. I wrote Preparation for the Next Life, and I'm going to talk about a few things that have been inspiring to me. The first thing I would mention is Charles Bowden's book, Murder City. Murder City is a piece of literary nonfiction about the killings that have been going on in Juarez, Mexico. The reason Charles Bowden matters so much to me and this book has such an impact on me is because it takes the underworld of drugs and turns it into nothing less than poetry, in my opinion. I was recently asked, do you read poetry? And I said, no, I don't read anything that is poetry by the name of poetry. But in my opinion, Charles Bowden is a poet. And his material couldn't be any stronger. He takes drugs and murder and darkness and turns them into the most amazing revelation.
The war was lost. The treaty signed. I was not cut. Across the line.
Okay, so the next thing that I'd like to mention is just yesterday I saw episode 1 of season 2 of the HBO show True Detective, and I was blown away by it. It had such a powerful feeling. Everything that they did, the images in the beginning, the feeling that they created, I just couldn't say enough about it. And I was especially wowed by, I hope I don't blank on his name, Colin Farrell. I'm always getting names wrong. Colin Farrell. I should know that because he's a pretty famous actor. But anyway, he's great. I'll go on to my third thing here. Let's do some music. I'm a giant AC/DC fan. I know this is going out to Australia, but in the interest of not constantly mentioning AC/DC, I'm going to say Sweet with their song Fox on the Run. I'm a giant Sweet fan. I just discovered them this year, taken back to the 70s, and I'm all about Sweet now. Let me talk about sports. I am a UFC fight fan. I love to watch the fights, and I think the UFC has influenced me highly. It's really been part of my life. I've been, like a lot of people, transfixed by mixed martial arts ever since it came out. I think Joe Rogan is a very good person to talk about it, and he probably speaks for me when he says this is interesting because it shows you what real fighting is, and that's something a lot of people want to see the answer to. Instead of giving you my favorite fight from the past, I'll tell you the fight that I most anticipate seeing will be Conor McGregor versus Jose Aldo in July. Of course, Conor McGregor is an extremely interesting and exciting fighter, and I can't wait to see what happens there. The last thing I'll mention is I've been highly influenced by Stanton Samanow, who is a criminologist who wrote a book called Inside the Criminal Mind. I just think it filled out my worldview. To me, crime plays a major role in life, and I've been troubled by how many people seem not to recognize criminals for who they are. And what I found refreshing about Stanton Samanow is that he sees crime and criminals for who they are in a way that is so new that it's old. It seems to be biblical. It seems to go back to the idea of a bad seed. Those are my picks. Thank you.
American writer Atticus Lish with TV, criminal analysis, and even a fight as part of what inspires him as a novelist. And his latest one is called Preparation for the Next Life, and you can find an interview with him on our website. Now, who do you reckon wrote this? Nice, isn't it? Well, the woman who wrote it, well, yes, who notated it, claims it's the work of the famed Hungarian composer Franz Liszt. Now, if you're confused, don't worry, because ABC sound librarians James Lee and Michael Munson are here to take you and me beyond the vinyl frontier. This is so weird, this story.
It's a great story.
Yes, the curious case of Rosemary Brown, a housewife from London.
That was her advertised. She was advertised as a housewife,
a normal housewife with a rudimentary understanding and grasp of music, who had taken some piano lessons in her youth for a couple of years. Wakes up one day and she starts composing these pieces that are communicated to her by, in this case, as you said, Franz Liszt, and this was communicated to her between the 29th of May and the 3rd of June, 1969. So Liszt had been kind of dead for quite a while by that stage.
Kind of dead, well and truly dead.
1886 he died, but he hadn't stopped composing, presumably.
Well, he wasn't alone. There was a number of other composers, famous composers, Chopin, Rachmaninoff, Beethoven was there.
Yeah, Grieg,
communicated many new works through Rosemary.
Yeah, Debussy, Schumann.
It's very Mozart. It's very hard to explain this one. The music, some of it's a bit dodgy, some of it's very good, but it's some of the complex music. There's no way she could have how she could have written it is a
Michael's quite
big question.
Open. He's quite open.
Well, it
to
is
it.
Mysterious.
Yes.
It's no definitely.
I mean, James, on the one hand, you think, oh, what a fruitcake. You know, how can that be? On the other hand, there is this music.
Yeah. How did she do it?
We've got a little grab of her explaining what she thinks is going on.
I can usually see Liszt quite clearly whilst he's communicating, although there are times when I hear his voice but cannot see him at all. When he offered to transmit Grubilai to me, in the presence of three British Broadcasting Corporation officials, I felt his presence in the room at first. Then he appeared very clearly before me, looking very calm. He gave this piece of music by the process of dictation, and it was some weeks before I could play it passably well after having been given tuition by him. This turned out to be rather complicated for me to follow, as the key signature contains six sharps, and the time signature is 5-4 in one hand against 3-2 in the other.
Well, that just sounds like an absolute nightmare. We'll just face her out there. But
he's given her a real challenge there.
Yeah.
And she's got these sort of three kind of very serious BBC
guys. Legitimised by
the fact that there's something called British Broadcasting Corporation officials.
Yeah.
I don't think we have officials, do we, at the ABC?
No, we don't.
Who witnessed these
things?
We
probably did one time.
France, six sharps or five sharps or whatever it is. Can't we just do it in C major? I'm just starting out here, but no.
Well, she couldn't play it, so...
And there's a theory that that's exactly why Liszt and all those other guys chose her, and it was because of her lack of musical education that would help to legitimise the theory that she was kind
of... When you say there's a theory, what do you mean there's a theory? Who has this theory?
Well, listen, at the time, the BBC were in on it. The many composers were very interested in her. Howard Shelley performed and recorded her works.
She had dinner with Novello
published the works.
It is weird. The piece we played at the start is called Grubelai. Yeah. Let's just hear, now that we know the background, let's hear a little bit of it all over again. Yeah. This is Grubelai
by Liszt. And look, I don't know much about these things, but musicologists have identified various Liszt-like themes and kind of signatures in there.
Definitely, and then they have their own characteristics. Yeah. How does one...
And so the question is, how does a housewife from London without any formal musical education or only a rudimentary understanding of how to play piano notate and compose a piece like this?
Perhaps she knew more about music than she was letting on.
No.
Well, she does have a detractors who have voiced opinions such as yours, Michael. her whole career was kind of basically defending criticism such as that, wasn't it,
Michael? Well, listen, her career started when, I think she might have been 50 when she sort of came out, so to speak. Because she'd been channeling since she was a child.
A child, yeah.
So it was a very normal thing, but she, of course, didn't want to, you know, come across as a nutcase.
No.
So,
well, who would?
Yeah.
But
I think it was Liszt spoke to her when she was a little girl and said, oh, we'll come back later when you have an understanding.
Get ready. We're going to be famous.
But it wasn't just composers. There were painters. She was painting too.
Was she?
Yeah, doing Van Gogh.
Matisse's and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of people in her head.
In her head, yeah.
Now, because you're librarians and you're marvellous, you've tracked down her book as well, which is called Unfinished Symphonies, Voices from the Beyond.
It's a great read.
That is a cracking
read. Every page
read.
is a great story.
It's a real page turner, isn't it?
If you can track this one down, it's published by Souvenir Press, came out in 1971.
And has been out of print since, I would imagine. But a cracking read. We've looked into it.
We could do a whole show on Rosemary.
Yeah, we could. We could
come back and do that. Let's move on. So what's the next one we've got?
We've got Alvin Lucier, who's a famous American composer. Came up with a lot of really interesting concepts. He was into acoustical phenomena and psychological effects. And this piece is one of the first of that sort of set him off on this trajectory. It's Music for Solo Performer.
Music for Solo Performer in brackets for enormously amplified brain waves and percussion. Alvin would sit there with some kind of things taped to his
EEG,
temples. EEG, right? And they'd be wired up to an amplifier. The amplifier would be kind of rigged up to these little speakers.
Yeah.
And the speakers would be put on top of our various kind of drums and cymbals and what
this
have you.
This is going to sound horrible.
No, already. No.
You know, we'll have a listen.
It's good to have low expectations.
Let's just have a listen. Let's have a listen, see how we enjoy it, and then we'll come back and have a little bit of a chat about it.
Okay.
So here's Alvin with Music for Solo Performer.
Turn it up.
Turn it up, Yuri. Crank it up, okay. Angie, crank it up. Angie Grant's our sound engineer today. And she's waving me back in because she's had enough.
Yeah, well,
I'm sorry.
Look, this is Angie's kind of thing.
And we've cut a good 10 minutes into it there. It does take a while for him to get warmed up. Because, I mean, it requires enormous amounts of concentration to actually make this happen.
Right.
So the album was released in 1982. He composed that piece in 1965 or something.
Something 64, maybe. But he's basically using a bit of medical gear that picks up alpha waves of the brain when the brain's having any activity.
Mm. So do you mean when you're listening to the album, you can feel the act of concentration? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't know what he's doing with his thoughts, but he's setting things off purely with thought.
Mm.
So it's a pretty cool thing.
It is very cool. We had a little listen. I mean,
imagine an orchestra.
First time on Radio National.
Imagine, hooray! I'm very proud. Imagine an orchestra of that.
Yeah. Well, in fact, you can the sort of choice of instrumentation is totally up for grabs. You can choose whatever instruments you like, and on the B side of that album, a female performer performs the piece and uses a lot of more world music, kind of ethnic percussion instruments, little gongs and stuff. So it's got a different kind of feel.
Just the performance thing. Instructions, you can pretty much make it sound the way you
this
want.
This is Books and Arts on RN, and you and I are journeying beyond the vinyl frontier, as we do from time to time with our sound librarians, James Lee and Michael Munson, who look after the enormous LP record collection. I wonder if that's a tautology. The LP collection, the vinyl collection here at the ABC, and they bring us treasures around a certain theme. And today we're talking about, well, I guess it's essentially brain power and music.
Mm. So, okay, we'll move on. Our next little gem from the library is a little single that we found, a little 7-inch bit of
treasure.
Vinyl. And it's called Moon Thing, and it's by someone called Bill Moonman Renfrey. A little bit of research proved that Bill Renfrey was a guest on a program called Spellbound that was hosted by Martin St. James, self-proclaimed greatest hypnotist on Earth.
Do you remember Martin St. James?
No, I don't.
No. Well, look, some of our friends over in Western Australia, Perth,
that's
might.
Because he hypnotised me, of course, memory.
You blocked it, yeah.
It's all gone.
Yeah. Well, there was
who knows what else he got up to.
There was alarm, you know, at the time. He was banned in other states aside from WA, I think.
Yeah, well, apparently the Spellbound, the television show, could be shown in Western Australia, but not in any other states of Australia because this kind of type of mass hypnosis, and that's what the show did. He would kind of get up there and get audience members hypnotised and then kind of encourage them to do silly things. And like Bill, for instance, was someone who Martin St. James had been able to convince was from the moon and can talk in a kind of foreign moon language. So he would have lots of fun in the studio and Bill would sit there and talk in moon language.
And Bill became a regular
part
of the show.
Yeah, Bill had a real 15 minutes of fame there in the kind of late 60s.
Must have been lonely talking in moon language, given that there's no one else respond.
You know what, though? He could also, Martin St. James could also hypnotise someone so that they could understand
of course.
What Bill was saying. So, he would then ask the person to translate. Anyways, cut a long story short, for some reason he released a single. He wrote a song. Bill sang it. Martin St. James wrote and produced.
No. This is not in moon language. You're not telling me he's going to sing it.
This is in moon language. And we can only presume that Bill is under hypnosis while performing this piece.
Oh, sure, he would be, for sure.
Okay, Angie, play it.
Let's chuck it on. Now, look, Michael, how's that? You were dancing. If that isn't
a
lost Australian
piece.
Classic,
it's good.
It's good. It's exciting. It's brilliant. It's a lost Australian classic. I'm putting it out there now.
Is that Bill Renfrew's only single? I mean, is there
I think that's it. I think Bill's 15 minutes were up.
You see, another country would have made that man a superstar.
No, no.
Yeah. So well,
he was a superstar in WA.
Cult might be a word that you might sort of...
Sorry to laugh, WA, yeah. But back in 1969, you can see why that might have been funny.
Interesting
thing, Martin performed at Festival Hall in 1969.
In Melbourne?
And was arrested.
Chased out of town, wasn't he?
Chased out of town.
Yeah.
So he broke the Psychological Practices Act.
Yeah, he did. He did. He was accused of breaking that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that still exists.
Alleged.
That act.
You have to say alleged.
Yeah, right.
Alleged.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, no, he was
charged. Oh, no, he was charged. That's not $200 fine.
Right, $200. Right, yeah. Okay.
I wonder whether he's still going round.
No, he died earlier this year.
Up on the Gold Coast. Yeah.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah.
All right. Muzak.
Let's do Muzak. Because, I mean, we're talking about ways in which the brain are affected by music. And the Muzak stimulus progression idea is a classic way that an American corporation is discovered to basically modify people's behaviour.
Mm.
Michael, talk us through what's going on.
To sell stuff. It's so if you were Muzak. Building a department store, yeah. Muzak will come along and they would.
This is in the 1970s.
This is like 1940s even.
Yeah. Oh,
they would wire up the building. So this is where the piped music comes from. That they would pipe the music through the building,
yeah.
And each department could have. They had this sort of bogus, scientific, theory behind it all. So
it's not just sort of. Inconsequential music. It's actually designed to encourage certain behaviours.
Yeah, sure. Very much so.
If you're looking at a pair of trousers in the the menswear department, there'd be music to go that would make you want to stay and
trouser
actually
music.
Make you want to buy that.
That's right. So we're going to listen to a little piece called Last Tango in Paris, and this is from an LP.
This is good trouser music.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm looking particularly fine in these trousers.
Yeah. You look $1 million.
Thank you very much. I think I'd like a shirt with this. Perhaps two shirts.
So they came up with this...
It works.
Yeah, it does, doesn't
stimulus
it?
Progression chart.
Oh.
Which is like a 15-minute blocks of moving upwards... So there's, as you can see, the graph is moving. Everything.
So this
moving
would be about
upwards.
Three quarters along, wouldn't it? This particular piece.
I'd imagine
this is fairly
so. Yeah.
Kind of up.
It's a form of mass hypnosis. People all over Australia run out to buy trousers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have to stop. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
It's been lovely
Michael.
To have you in here. We'll have to leave Uri Geller, the Uri Geller track, for another
next time.
Uri,
next time.
Our ABC Sound librarians, James Lee and Michael Munson, taking us once again beyond the vinyl frontier. And thanks as ever to you.